It was sunset before Jim could tear himself away from the captured encampment. Leaving Zama and half of his tiny force to guard the ivory and the herds, they set off back to the lager. The dazzling panoply of stars lit their way. As the group passed the corpses of the Nguni who had died that day, hyena and jackal scattered before the horses. When they were almost within sight of the wagon lager, they reined in their horses and stared at the night sky with awe. A mystic glow rose over the eastern horizon and lit the world so clearly that they could see each other's startled faces turned upwards. It was as though the sun was rising from the wrong direction. They watched in awe as an enormous fireball climbed over the horizon and hurtled silently overhead. Some of the herd boys whimpered and pulled their blankets over their heads. "'Tis nothing but a shooting star," Jim reached across to take Louisa's hand and reassure her. "They are common visitors in these African skies. This one is a little larger than most."
"It is the spirit of Manatasi," small boy cried. "She begins her journey to the land of shades."
"The death of kings," Buckhart whimpered. "The fall of tribes, war and death."
"An omen of the worst kind," Zama shook his head.
"I thought I'd civilized you," Jim laughed. "But you're still a crew of superstitious savages at heart." The gigantic heavenly body swept down into the west, leaving its fiery trail clear across the sky behind it as it disappeared below the horizon. It lit the sky for the rest of the night and the next, and for many nights thereafter. By its ghostly light they reached the wagon lager. They found old Tegwani, spear in hand, his beautiful granddaughter at his side, guarding it like a pair of faithful watchdogs. Although they were all nearly at the end of their tether, Jim roused the camp again before dawn. Using a span of oxen and with much shouting and cracking of long whips, they heaved the overturned wagon back onto its wheels. The robust vehicle had suffered little damage, and within a few hours they had repacked its scattered load. Jim knew that they must leave the battlefield at once. In the heat of the sun, the corpses would very soon putrefy, and with the stench of their rotting, sickness and disease would come. At his orders, they inspanned every other wagon in the train. Then small boy and the other drivers fired the long whips, and the oxen trundled the vehicles out of the gruesome lager and into the open grassland. They set up camp that evening among the deserted thatched huts of the Nguni town, surrounded by the vast herds of humpbacked cattle, with the piles of ivory securely enclosed within the wagon lager. The next morning, after breakfast, Jim summoned all his men to the Indaba. He wanted to explain to them his future plans and to tell them where he would lead them next. First, he asked Tegwani to explain how the Nguni used their cattle to carry the ivory when they were on the march. "Tell us how they place the loads and secure them on the backs of the animals," Jim ordered.
"That I do not know," Tegwani admitted. "I have only watched their advance from afar."
"Small boy will be able to work out the harness for himself," Jim decided. "But it would have been better to use a method to which the cattle are accustomed." Then he turned to the small group of herd boys and said, "Can you men," they liked to be called men, and they had earned the right at the barricades, "can you men take care of so many?" They considered the vast herds of cattle that were scattered down the full length of the valley.
"They are not so very many," said the eldest, who was the spokesman. "We can herd many more than that," said another.
"We have vanquished the Nguni in battle," squeaked Izize, smallest and cheekiest of the boys, his voice not yet broken. "We can take care of their cattle and their women also when we capture them."
"It may be, Izize," the name Jim had given him meant little flea, "it may be that neither your whip nor your whistle are yet large enough for those tasks." Izizi's companions shrieked with laughter.
"Show it to us," they cried, and tried to catch him.
But like the insect that was his namesake, he was quick and agile.
"Show us the weapon that will terrify the women of the Nguni."
Clinging to his loincloth to preserve his modesty and dignity, Izizi fled, pursued by his peers. "All of which brings us no closer to a solution of the problem," Jim remarked, as he and Louisa made the final inspection of the lager's defences before turning in for the night. Although it seemed apparent that the Nguni Impis had been shattered and would not return, Jim was taking no chances. He set his sentries at nightfall, and the next morning they stood to their guns in the dawn.
"Sweet heavens!" Jim exclaimed as the light strengthened. "They've returned!"
He seized Louisa's arm and pointed out to her the rows of shadowy figures squatting just out of musket shot beyond the barricades of the laager.
"Who are they?"
she whispered, though in her heart she knew the answer well.
"Who else but the Nguni?" he told her grimly. "I had thought that it was over, the killing and the fighting. God grant that it was enough."
"We shall soon find out," he said, and called for Tikwani. "Hail them," he ordered the old man. "Tell them that I will send our lightning down upon them as I did to Manatasi." Tegwani climbed shakily onto the side of the wagon and called across the open grassland. A voice answered him from among the gathered Nguni, and a long-shouted exchange followed.
"What do they want?" Jim demanded impatiently. "Do they not know that their queen is dead and their impis shattered?" "They know it well," Tegwani said. "They have seen her head carried upon the assegai as they fled the battlefield, and her fiery spirit passing in the night sky as she travelled to meet her forefathers."
"Then what is it that they want?"
"They want to speak with the wizard who struck down their queen with his lightning."
"A parley," Jim explained to Louisa. "It seems that these are some of the survivors of the battle."
"Talk to them, Jim," she urged. "Perhaps you can prevent any more bloodshed. Anything is better than that."
Jim turned back to Tikwani.
"Tell their Induna, their leader, that he must come into the laager alone and unarmed. I will not harm him."
He came, dressed in a simple kilt of leather strips, without headdress or weapons. He was a fine-looking man in his middle years, with the body and limbs of a warrior and a handsome moon face, the chocolate colour of freshly hewn mabanga wood. As soon as he entered the laager, he recognised Jim. He must have seen him upon the battlefield. He went down on one knee, an attitude of respect, clapping his hands and chanting praises.
"Mightiest of warriors, invincible wizard who comes out of the great waters, devourer of impis, slayer of Manatasi, greater than all her fathers."
"Tell him that I see him and that he may approach me," Jim ordered. He realized the significance and importance of this delegation and assumed a dignified manner and haughty expression. The Induna went down on all fours and crawled towards him. He took Jim's right foot and placed it on his own bowed head. Jim was taken by surprise and almost lost his balance, but he recovered swiftly.
"Great white bull elephant," the Induna chanted. "Young in years, but mighty in power and wisdom, grant me mercy."
From his father and his uncle, Jim had learned enough of African protocol to know how to conduct himself.
"Your worthless life is mine," he said, "mine to take or spare. Why should I not send you on the same road through the sky as the one on which I sent Manatasi?" "I am a child without a father or mother. I am an orphan. You have taken my children from me."
"What is he talking about?" Jim demanded angrily of Tegwani. "We killed no children?" The Induna heard his tone and realized he had given offense. He pressed his face into the dirt. When he answered Tegwani's questions, his voice was hoarse with dust. Jim used the opportunity to remove his foot from the Induna's head. Standing on one leg was uncomfortable and undignified. At last, Tegwani turned back to Jim.
"He was Manatasi's keeper of the royal herds. He calls the cattle his children. He begs you either to kill him or to allow him the honour of becoming your keeper of the herds."
Jim stared at the man in astonishment.
"He wants to work for me as my chief herdsman? He says he has lived with the herds since he was a child. He knows each animal by name, which bull covered their dams. He knows each one's age and temper. He knows the remedy and the treatment for every disease to which the herds are prone. With his own assegai he has killed 5 lions who were attacking the animals. What is more..."
Tegwani paused to draw breath. "Enough," Jim stopped him hastily. "I believe what he says. But what of these others? He pointed at the other files of squatting figures outside the laager. Who are they?
They are his herders. Like him, they have been dedicated to the care of the royal cattle since childhood. Without the herds, their lives are without purpose.
They, too, are offering themselves? Jim was having difficulty grasping the extent of his good fortune.
Every one of them wishes to become your man.
And what do they expect from me?
They expect you to kill them if they err or fail in their duties, Tegwani assured him. Manatasi would have done so.
That's not exactly what I meant, Jim said in English, and Tegwani looked baffled. He went on quickly.
What do they expect in return for their work?
The sunshine of your pleasure, said Tegwani, as I do.
Jim pulled his ear thoughtfully, and the Induna rolled his head to watch his face, worried that their request would be denied, and that the white wizard would strike him down as he had the queen. Jim was considering the expense of adding the Induna and 50 or 60 of his comrades to the strength of his already numerous crew. However, there seemed to be no additional cost that he could fathom. From what Tegwani had told him, he knew these herders would live on the blood and milk of the herds, and the venison that fell to his gun. He was sure he could expect a most extraordinary level of loyalty and dedication in return. These were skilled cattlemen and fearless spearmen. He would find himself at the head of his own tribe of warriors. With the Hottentot musketeers and the Nguni spearmen, he need fear nothing in this wild and savage land. He would be a king.
"What is this man's name?" he asked Tegwani.
"He is called Nkunzi, for he is the bull of all the royal herds.
Tell Nkunzi that I look with favour on his request. He and his men are now my men. Their lives are in my hands."
"Bayedi!" Nkunzi shouted with joy when he heard this. "You are my master and my son."
Once again he placed Jim's right foot upon his head, and his men, seeing this, knew they had been accepted. They rose to their feet, drummed on their shields with their assegais, and shouted together,
"Bayeti, we are your men. You are our son."
"Tell them that the sun can warm a man, but it can also burn him to death," Jim warned him solemnly.
Then he turned to Louisa and explained to her what had just taken place. Louisa looked upon this fearsome band of warriors and remembered how, only days before, they had come singing to the laager.
"Can you trust them, Jim? Should you not disarm them?"
"I know the traditions of these people. Once they have sworn their allegiance, I will trust them with my life."
"And mine," she pointed out softly.